Our second lecture today is going to be given to us by Dr. Joseph Salerno, and the title of his lecture is Calculation and Socialism.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Mark, for that introduction, brief as it was. So as Mark said, I'm going to be talking about calculation and socialism. I'm going to hope to show how socialism or a socialist economy is impossible. Okay, I'm going to defend Mises' thesis that calculation under socialism cannot exist, and because there is no calculation, there in effect cannot be any economy in a real sense. So let me start by bringing your attention to the most important article written in 20th century economic thought, Economic Calculation in the Socialist Commonwealth. It was given in 1919, presented at a conference, published in 1920, and then incorporated into Mises' great book, Socialism, in 1922. It is the greatest article in my estimation in the 20th century in economic thought. The second greatest is Murray Rothbard's Toward a Reconstruction of Utility and Welfare Economics. So I highly recommend both of those. There were watershed moments in economics. They changed the way economists thought about certain topics. In Mises' case, it was socialism. Before I go on, I would like to draw your attention to a notable epilogue by a contemporary Austrian, very important epilogue. It's a postscript, actually. Why a Socialist Economy is Impossible. And it's really explained and put in perspective, okay, what Mises was talking about. And the author is there, so. Okay. But you actually might want to read those in tandem. You want to read Mises' article first, and then I think my short article afterward. So what did Mises' article do? Basically, it destroyed the intellectual foundations of the case for market planning, for socialist planning. And second, at the same time, it represented a revolutionary breakthrough in the necessity and centrality of a price system to a functional economy. Okay, it showed just why it was impossible to allocate resources, that is, to use them in their most highly valued use in some sense of that word, without a price system. And it presented a new theory in economics, a theory of monetary calculation, showing that really it's money prices that allows entrepreneurs to calculate, to plan, to allocate resources. And that any planner in the economic system, anybody planning production, needs prices. Now, let me just talk about the debate over socialism before Mises wrote. Okay. The initial proponents of socialism were called the utopian socialists. They were mainly French. I'll put some of their names up here. There was Charles Fourier, Henri Saint-Simon, and a British writer, Robert Owen. Okay, so we'll just focus on utopian socialism. What they did was come up with all these crazy plans to transform society into their pet utopian schemes and projects. For example, Fourier, who was certifiably crazy, said things like, once we have the dawning of socialism, we'll literally have roasted chickens flying through the air into the mouths of the hungry people. Oceans will turn to lemonade, and lions will allow you to ride them. I mean, this is in his writings. Even more crazy, he wanted to set up phalanxes, which is the Roman army formation of 1,500 to 1,600 people. And he even drew up plans. So it would be communal living, there'd be one big kitchen. He wanted to free women from oppression and exile from individual homes. So here's what he had in mind. Okay, they were always very specific about their crazy schemes. They drew pictures. They wrote out detailed schemes and so on. Okay, so that's the phalanstery in English. It's a phalanstère in French. So he claimed it should look like that. Well, Horace Greeley, the New York newspaper editor, and a guy named Albert Brisbane actually tried to start a phalanstery a few miles from where I live in New Jersey. Okay, and that's what it looks like now. It looks like a hellhole. I mean, probably even then, it's creepy, ugly. Here's an even better picture of it. It's like a haunted house that you would go to on Halloween. But anyway, the longest lasting phalanstery in the U.S., because they weren't really built in France, was 12 years. Okay, and it was that particular one that lasted for 12 years. And they were going to support themselves through some agriculture, but also by having people come. If people wanted to visit people there, they had to pay. So they figured that would be a great source of income. Okay, they're great entrepreneurs, right? Okay. Now, interestingly enough, one of Fourier's followers, Victor Considerant, said, well, you know, we could also have this sort of living arrangement on a steamboat in the middle of the ocean. Okay, so this is what they were thinking. Now, this was terribly embarrassing. Well, these guys were easily refuted by the classical economists. So the classical economists basically said, look, who's going to take out the garbage under socialism? That is, if everyone is treated equally, if everyone gets equal shares of the output of the commune, then who's going to do the dirty, unhealthy, just jobs that no one wants? Who's going to do those jobs? Who's going to take out the garbage? Who's going to go down into the coal mines, okay, and risk health and life mining coal in dangerous and claustrophobic conditions? How are you going to motivate people to do those things? So they basically use supply and demand to show that, or to argue that, in fact, socialism wouldn't work. But the socialists came back with a response, and that is that what would emerge was a new socialist man who would no longer be motivated by monetary income, but they'd be motivated by service. They never explained exactly how this was going to take place. Okay. So that's where the debate stood. Before Karl Marx entered with a brilliant ploy, Karl Marx was terribly embarrassed by the so-called utopian socialists. He thought they were unscientific, and they were basically just stupid. So he introduced the term scientific socialism. Now, what was Marx's ploy? What he did was he wanted everybody to shut up about what socialism would look like, because he himself never wrote a word on what the socialist economy would look like. All his works were basically aimed at criticizing capitalism. Hence the name of his great treatise, Das Kapital, Capital. So what he did was to say, look, socialism is going to succeed capitalism with the inevitability of the laws of nature, okay? There are historical laws that determine that we move from one stage to the next. Each stage embodies a thesis, okay? An affirmation of that stage and a negation of that stage, an antithesis. And eventually what's going to happen is that the stage is going to break down and it's going to turn into the synthesis of the next stage. So classical Greek slavery broke down, turned into feudalism. Okay, feudalism as what he called the forces of production developed, that is, as technology and productive organization developed, it burst the stage, okay, it burst through the shell of the previous stage. So feudalism gave rise to commercial capitalism. Commercial capitalism after the Industrial Revolution gave rise to industrial capitalism. And industrial capitalism was going to, with absolute necessity, give rise to the stage of socialism. And some people say there's a sort of a final stage of communism. But in any case, you are unscientific if you try to talk about what that socialist stage would look like, because it didn't matter. You couldn't make it come any faster or any slower. There's no reason to contemplate what it would look like. It was going to arrive. Okay. So everyone shut up. Okay. No one wanted to be labeled unscientific. So what occurred then was There wasn't much discussion. There was some discussion about the morality of socialism and its effect on human morality. There was some discussion about incentives under socialism, but the debate sort of ended until von Mises' famous article. Okay. So what was Mises' argument? Okay, this is an argument that was not made by the classical economists. This went way beyond the incentive argument about who's going to take out the garbage. Mises' thesis, in red, was very simple and straightforward. He said that the rational allocation of resources is impossible without economic calculation using actual market prices, prices determined as a result of interactions of people's value scales on the real, in real world markets. And he had a very simple argument. I'll go through the steps and then we'll go through it in more detail. He said, socialism abolishes private property and in capital goods and natural resources. There was a small book, it's been neglected, by a German economist named Albert Schaeffler. And what he wrote, it was called The Quintessence of Socialism. It was translated into English. It was written in the 1860s. But he looked at all socialist schemes of the past, and he said that there's one thing that they all have in common, even though there's all these crazy idiosyncratic schemes that each person has, they all have one thing in common. They all want to abolish private property. Okay. So Mises knew about this. And so Mises defined socialism as a system in which, it was very, very, very strictly defined, a system in which private property in the means of production is abolished. That is, no one can privately own natural resources or capital goods. They can own their own labor, okay? In some social schemes you can't, but in Mises' depiction, you can own your own labor and you can own personal items, okay? Clothing, toothbrushes, things like that. So the next step is, okay, if you abolish private property and capital goods and natural resources, then the socialist state is a sole owner of these factors of production. So there's no longer any exchange. You can't exchange steel with itself or coal with itself. Therefore, if there's no more exchange, there can be no prices. If there are no prices, you can't have costs of production. So you will never, without cost of production, of course, then there's no way to calculate profit and loss. And profit and loss indicates where resources are wrongly being allocated, where they are being used for undervalued uses, and where the higher valued uses lie. Okay. So there was no way to tell how to allocate resources in a social system. That was Mises' challenge to the socialists. Now let me just go on and say a few more things about that. Let me give you an example. Let me just talk about the thesis a little bit more. Okay. Here's a quote from Mises, which really sums up what he was talking about. He says, the essential mark of socialism, okay, it's not totalitarianism, it's not a lack of knowledge, the fact that the central planners can't know everything that the entrepreneurs know. It's that there is one will alone acts. It is immaterial whose will it is. It could be Mother Teresa's, it could be Stalin's, it doesn't matter. You could have goodwill, you could be a misanthrope and hate humanity. The main thing is that the employment of all factors of production is directed by one agency only. One will alone chooses, decides, directs, acts, gives orders. The distinctive mark of socialism is the oneness and indivisibility of the will directing all production activities within the whole social system. So what is he saying there? With one will, you cannot have exchange. You cannot have prices. You need people with different expectations, different wills, different value scales, interacting with one another on markets to have prices. One will cannot generate prices, no matter how smart or how much goodwill that person has. And by one will, he's also talking about a collective, too. I mean, it could be that you have a planning board that has 50 people on it, but they're all agreeing on one decision, okay? They're not exchanging between themselves. So there was something else he mentioned, and that was that in order to have economic calculation, this is the positive case for economic calculation, what do you need? You need private property in all stages of goods, including capital goods of every kind. In other words, people have to be able to own steel. They have to be able to own copper mines. They have to be able to own electric utilities in order for us to have prices of all those things. Okay? In order for those things to be directed into the best uses according to the profit and loss test. Socialism abolishes private property and the means of production. So that all of these are necessary, okay, but not sufficient. You need all three together. Freedom to exchange all kinds of goods and services. Well, if you can't own goods in the higher stages of production, meaning capital goods and natural resources, well, then you don't obviously have the freedom to exchange these things. And a sound money, a money whose value is independent of political influence. Well, socialism destroys all three of those preconditions. Even the money that they use, since it's really just used to pay labor who can then buy consumer goods, even that is simply a voucher. It's not a real full-bodied money as Philip Baggus was talking about yesterday that can be exchanged against all goods in society. So what's the problem if you have no economic calculation? Let me give you an example. And I'm going to ask you to ignore my chicken scratch to the right and just focus on this production function for an automobile. When we talk about a production function, for those who have not had economics, all we mean is that the product that you're producing is a function of combining certain resources. So let's say the socialist planner has all the technological knowledge, all of the scientists and engineers. He has access to all people that participate in production. So he knows, or at least the managers of the plant that he's directing, knows how to produce an automobile. He used P tons of steel plus Q hours of machine time plus unskilled labor plus engineering labor, certain amounts of each of these goods, okay? And that will bring into existence, okay, you can transform all of those things into one automobile, okay? Now, there's a few problems with that. They know how to produce the automobile, but the question is, should we produce the automobile? That's the first question. Should it be produced? How do we know that in a market economy that we should produce a particular automobile, that we should produce a hybrid, and that we should stop producing maybe very large gas-guzzling SUVs? How do the entrepreneurs know that? They know that because they simply compare the price of the automobile, there's a price for the automobile, let's say it's $21,000, with the combined prices of the factors of production, which we call in total the costs of production. By comparing the automobile price to the, let's say cost of production is $18,000, well, including interest, okay, an interest return on the capital invested, well, then there's a $3,000 per unit profit, and they will go ahead and build the automobile. Not only will they benefit, but consumers will benefit because they've taken resources that were worth $18,000, okay? That is, why did they have to pay $18,000 for those resources? Because entrepreneurs from all other industries were bidding for the steel, for the engineering labor, for the factory space. And that $18,000 reflects the aggregate value of those goods in the next best use. So they're taking goods from undervalued uses. The entrepreneur that intervenes and buys these goods for $18,000, capital goods and natural resources, and transforms them into the automobile, is benefiting consumers. Let me give you a more stark example. Back in the 1980s, there was a woman who worked for IBM. Her name was Tomima Edmark. What she found was she was an executive and she wanted a fast way to put a French twist in her hair. And so she put together sort of a knitting needle and a plastic hoop and did that. And people commented on it. She then decided that she was going to invest some money in producing these things. And she began to invest money in, I think it cost her a dollar to produce them. And she found some magazine that she could advertise in. And so she was producing, selling maybe a couple hundred as a side business a month. And she had her, and she was selling them at $10 or something like that. And she was making a little bit of profit. Then she tried to make a commercial, and she got a commercial on television. And then the price went up to $15, and her cost fell to 80 cents. And then some somebody connected with QVC saw this, either the commercial or I don't remember, I don't have the article in front of me, or the magazine article on this device. And so she went on QVC and she sold hundreds of thousands. She got a buyout package from IBM and she became a millionaire within a year. What did she do? She took $1 worth, she took a plastic hoop that was used for whatever it was used and a knitting needle in another use. So it was worth $1 to consumers in those other uses, and she transformed them into a device that had much higher value to consumers, $15. Okay. So she knew enough to do that because of difference in price of the cost of production and prices or anticipated prices. And she has since gone on and tried to market other things, but she's never been as successful as she was with what's called, I think it's called Topsy Curl. Yeah. So in any case, now, is that to say that entrepreneurs don't make mistakes? No, of course. They can miscalculate. They can miscalculate in the following sense. Remember, you're always producing the automobile for the future. In the U.S., from the used to be the 1990s, it would take 7 years from the drawing board to the automobile dealer's showroom for a car to be produced. In Japan, it was 5 years, but you were producing for future markets. So you have to estimate the price. You have to forecast the price. So if it turns out that the car, the automobile costs $21,000, but the cost of, or let's say, the cost of production are $18,000, but the automobile only sells for $17,000 because they've misestimated the demand, then they've made a mistake. But the point is, they were able to calculate and make rational decisions. Okay. Everyone makes mistakes under uncertainty. That doesn't denote irrationality. That just indicates the fact that we're uncertain, that as imperfect human beings, we can't know the future. Okay. However, now, the planner doesn't know whether he should build, let's say, another factory for building automobiles, or build more bicycles or motorcycles with those same resources. He has no way of knowing. Or even whether he should build more health clubs using the steel and the labor and so on. He has no idea. So that's why socialist production is chaotic. It's destined to be chaotic. Now, one thing Mises was not saying, he was not saying that all economies need economic calculation. Very small household economies. I'll use Robinson Crusoe, but you could also think of certainly Native American Indians before the Europeans conquered the North America. There were about 14 million living in North America from Mexico up through Canada. And they were barely getting by, but they were getting by, okay? So they were living in small, what we call household economies or autarkic economies, isolated economies. They wouldn't interact with one another. There was no division of labor, as Dr. Hulsman talked about yesterday. But they could still produce very simple things. So Mises doesn't deny that. So just to take this as an example, let's say that Crusoe works for 12 hours. That wouldn't be me. So 12 hours out of the 24 hours of the day he devotes to fishing, working. And let's say each of these alternatives take 3 hours. So let's say he allocates his time to producing 2 fish, 3 pounds of wild mushrooms, 8 coconuts, and 1 sack of berries. So really, there's only his labor that's being allocated. Okay, it's very simple. So he doesn't need calculation. He can simply value the things that one factor of production will bring to him. Okay, well, actually two. There's also time involved. And he can value his time versus leisure. Now, what if he sees a rabbit on the island and he figures it's going to take him 6 hours to produce? Okay. Well, he will know the cost. He will know. He can compare benefits and costs. He knows what the benefit of eating the rabbit is, the satisfaction from eating the rabbit. And he can compare that to the satisfaction of the lowest two uses of those 3 hours each. So he would need 6 hours, so he'd have to give up the prospective satisfaction from the 8 coconuts and 1 sack of berries. So we can make that comparison very easily. But once you have an economy, an industrial economy, where you have many, many different types of capital goods, you have a multitude of capital goods, where technology will allow you to produce anything from anything else, where there's literally, if you take the U.S. economy today, OK, okay, and all its resources, including all the different skills of labor and locations of labor, all the natural resources, and all of the diverse capital goods, you can literally have an infinity of different allocations of resources. You can produce different goods and services in many different proportions, okay? You couldn't even exhaust them in a lifetime by trying to go through everything you produce. So out of all those things, what do you produce? Monetary calculation, anything you can think of to produce will give you, you can calculate. You can find out the cost of production and you can estimate what the price would be, okay? Even if it's a new good, okay? So when Apple estimated, when they produced the iPad, there wasn't any tablet computers in existence. They had to make an estimate. And given their experience with other types of computers and so on, there is a way to make a reasonable estimate. And so they did that. And they were successful. Okay? So, let me just give you a sort of a real world example. This is one that I personally know of. I have a friend who I grew up with. She married a cowboy, a real cowboy, and moved to Montana. Tremendous loss of a Jersey girl. She still comes back and shops at all the malls, of course, every year. So I don't know, about a decade ago or maybe 15 years ago, she called me up and she says, "Oh, we got a new house." And I said, "Oh, would you move?" She said, "No, we didn't move." I said, "Well, how'd you get a new house?" She said, "Well, we just had our present house taken down and a new one was shipped in." So I said, "Hello? What are you talking about?" Well, what happens is in Montana, labor is extremely scarce. So people don't have houses built on site, right? Because everybody's a cowboy and they're out, on the ranches and stuff. So nobody's, it'd be very expensive to get somebody to build houses for you, to get a crew of construction workers. Instead, they have the house built in Nebraska, in a giant factory. And then it's shipped on these huge double wide, wide load type trailers out there. So she had a bigger house, then the modular pieces are shipped and then they put it together. Okay. So they use a much more capital intensive way of building a home rather than a labor intensive way, correct? So in the Northeast, which is very densely populated, okay, and you have a lot of labor in any given place, well, then you use a lot of labor and you use fewer capital goods. Okay. So to go back to our example, well, first of all, in this case, could a social planner ever figure this out, that you should build a house over 1,000 miles away and ship it? No, it doesn't ring true. Intuitively, it doesn't seem right. But there are people there, entrepreneurs, who are looking at prices, who are looking at cost of production, saying, this might be profitable. I'm going to try it. Okay. So not only do you have the problem, should we produce the automobile or other goods, but should we use more machine time, not just Q hours, but Q plus A, and less labor, in other words, make it more capital intensive, R minus B, and more kilowatt hours of electricity, okay, U plus C. I mean, there are many different ways of producing that car. And should we produce it with steel bumpers, which are kind of heavy, but are more crash resistant, or fiberglass bumpers, which are lighter, okay, but they cost less, or with titanium bumpers, which cost a lot more, but will not dent it and so on. They have no idea of what materials to use, right? So the whole thing is chaotic. So let me just sum up. What Mises would say then is that because of the lack of calculation, a socialist economy is literally impossible, okay? It cannot calculate the opportunity costs of production and investment decisions. What industries to invest in, and once you invest in those decisions in that industry, exactly what technology to use to produce the goods. There is no way that they can figure that out. So what Mises says is that the socialist planner is like a man lost in a desert without a compass. He can go almost an infinitude of different ways, right? Every degree you can, but he doesn't know which way to go. Okay. He's groping in the dark. Okay. Whereas the entrepreneur has a compass. He's fallible. He can misread the compass. He can make mistakes, but he can calculate in some sense. Okay. And in fact, Mises really called socialist planning an oxymoron because and you replace it with planned chaos. It's trying to plan, but resulting in chaos. So he says that socialism is like a crazy machine that runs and runs without any purpose. And let me give you an example of that in the form of the famine in the USSR in the 1980s, which ultimately brought down the East Bloc. So if you toured the Soviet Union, what you would have seen in the mid-80s was fields of unharvested grain. There were a lot of grain out in the fields. There were empty silos. So the grain was in the fields. The silos were there ready to be used, the capital goods. There were rusting tractors. Well, we were having this famine. Why wasn't this grain being harvested? Well, because there weren't any laborers. There wasn't any diesel fuel for the tractors. Where were the laborers? The laborers were producing steel, which would produce tractors, which would then rust in the fields. So the whole thing is just a crazy machine. It doesn't work. In fact, Yuri Maltsev, who was likes to call himself the last defector from Russia, right before the whole thing fell apart from the Soviet Union, he was an economist. He was an advisor to Gorbachev. He just said that what they did was they just produce steel, and steel itself is just counted as part of the output, even though it was never used, even though it was just piling up, okay? He also told me never to drink Stolochnaya vodka, because he toured the plants there. So I became an absolute man after that. All right, now how did they actually try to produce? What they did was, they had a planning agency, and it was called Ghost Plan. That was the Russian term for it. And they engage in gross output planning. And gross output planning is very simple. What you do is you break down the targets of what each industry is to produce. So there was a commissar in charge of each industry. And then the commissar in charge of each industry would tell each factory that was in that industry how much their target was. Now, this, of course, led to mutual lying, right? Because you were rewarded if you exceeded your target, right? And you were sent, you got a vacation in Siberia in the gulag if you continually missed your target. But on the other hand, if you exceeded your target and got that nice bonus and got a nice vacation on the Black Sea, what would happen though, the next year, guess what would happen? Your target would go up. So everyone would lie, all the managers would say, no, we can produce only so much. And then the commissars would know they're lying, and they would raise the target, and so on. So there was a mutual lying there. What was interesting, though, is you can't really specify quality when you're talking about all these different goods. So you had certain things occurring, notable events, like women's clothing was all made in large sizes because they specified how much women's clothing could be produced in terms of yards of cloth used. Right? The building nails, famous example. Building nails were specified in terms of tons. Okay, so it was cheaper and used fewer resources to produce a big nail that was heavier than a number of small nails that were added up to the same weight but were more costly to produce. Okay, there were many commercial buildings and residential buildings in the Soviet Union that were empty. They were completely built, but they didn't have enough small roofing nails to put the roofs on. So they had no roofs on them. Okay, and they couldn't be used. And so there was a famous cartoon. I couldn't get a hold of it on the internet, but I drew it. Okay, so there's a commissar, one of those big hats on, you know, they wear those fur hats. And then there's the factory manager, and he's pointing to this huge nail that's on a train, and he's saying, "Well, comrade, I've met my target." Okay. That's obviously an exaggeration, but that's what this gross output planning without economic calculation led to. Okay. And finally, there was Khrushchev, the Soviet dictator in the 50s, who was overthrown in 61 or 62. Oh, after 62, maybe 63. During one of the speeches to the Politburo, he began to berate the chandelier industry because, you know, the chandeliers, of course, were for the Soviet apparatchiks, the people who, the rulers. And they were in their dachas, which were their vacation homes at the Black Sea. And they were also in the halls where they met together and so on. Well, it turns out that the chandelier industry was producing such heavy chandeliers, they were pulling the roofs down, the ceilings down on the comrades. So it was widespread enough that Khrushchev actually commented on it. Okay. And then there was a joke that was often told to Western economists that would meet Soviet economists at various conferences and so on. And that was that, Khrushchev's famous line was, "We will bury you," meaning we will bury you economically. We're more productive. And once he banged his shoe on the table at the UN when he was giving a talk and he yelled, "We will bury you." And anyway, to make a long story short, the Soviet economists said, "Yes, we'll bury you economically, but we're going to leave, the whole world's going to be communist eventually because it's more efficient and so on. But we're going to leave Hong Kong capitalist because we need to know what prices are." And in fact, now, some of the criticisms of Mises' impossibility thesis was that, it sounds nice theoretically, but look, the Soviet Union lasted from 1917 to 1991. And back in the 80s and 70s, they used to say, Mises was refuted by the very fact that the Soviet Union existed. Well, Mises took that into account in his very first article. He said, look, the Soviet Union is not true socialism. It's like the post office in the middle of a capitalist economy. You have a post office, which is, we all know, it's extremely inefficient, or used to be very, very inefficient, okay? But they can at least calculate by using the new technology and the prices that they see around them. Well, the same thing is true of a socialist economy in a capitalist world. They can use prices all around them. And that's exactly what they did. The USSR utilized world prices to calculate, okay? World prices for steel, energy, coal, diamonds, okay? Now, it didn't exactly reflect the scarcity of these materials in the Soviet Union, so they were still grossly inefficient, but there was some calculation that was occurring. And also they engaged in foreign trade. They bought and sold certain things with the West, so they did have real prices for those things. There were also black markets. By the 1960s and 70s, there were black markets, for example, in jeans and Beatles records and between factories. There was a black market in wood and so on. If one factory had too much wood and not enough steel, they would actually barter. So there were actually prices, and the authorities allowed these markets, they could have crushed them, but they allowed them to continue because they could look at the prices. Okay. So I did want to say, though, communism was actually enforced in the Soviet Union, but only from 1917 to 1921. Okay, it was called war communism. Okay, when the Bolshevik Revolution was still going on, when they were still fighting the Red Armies, were still fighting the White Armies. What they did was they implemented a leap to socialism in which they didn't use any sort of accounting. Okay, they didn't use any attempt to use any money prices at all. And what happened was that the factories literally just stopped after a while. And people began to literally first burn all their furniture to keep warm during the winter and then began dismantling their homes and burning it. So, and they started moving to the countryside where they would simply prey on the countryside, just prey on they were just predators, like all bands of human beings that were just looking for food anywhere and so on. So basically what socialism leads to, you can have socialism if you want to conceive of it as a society in which there's no division of labor, but just roving bands of predators, okay? And by the way, that occurred under Pol Pot's regime in Cambodia when he emptied out the cities and people had to live off the land, okay? So the whole economy collapsed. Okay, let me just mention one other thing here. All of us, not just entrepreneurs, but all of us are engaged in pricing or in an economic calculation. Let me just explain how that occurs. The entrepreneur is at the center, okay? He knows what prices are today, okay? And on the basis of those prices and on what he thinks people will want in the future, he makes forecasts of consumer tastes, resources, technology, and so on, okay? And that's how the iPad came into existence, okay? It was a forecast. It didn't exist before, but there was experience. So we're not saying the entrepreneur just guesses, right? Now, when he does that, and as all the entrepreneurs are doing this in all different industries, okay, they then have these forecast trends, and they transform this qualitative knowledge about what people will like and so on into what they think its effect will be on prices in the future, on future markets. What will be the price of the iPad you know, 2 years from when it came out in 2010. So they were, let's say they were planning in 2007, 2006. They were estimating what the price would be in 2010. Okay. So all of them, all entrepreneurs and all industries estimate these prices. Okay. And those prices are determined by consumer value scales, what you and I buy. So we're involved at that end. We're also involved at the other end, the resource end. Okay. The entrepreneurs then, with those prices in mind of the things that they produce, will then bid for the resources, for all the capital goods that are available, all the different grades and skills of labor, natural resources, and you'll get a whole structure of resource prices. So if you, right now, today, right now, every single good, whether it be a consumer good, capital good, natural resource, has a price in the U.S. economy, let's say. At every moment in time succeeding this moment, there are prices, and they're changing, okay? And they're changing as a result of an interaction of all of us, our value scales, our expectations of the future, the entrepreneur's forecasts and expectations of the future, how much we value money versus how much we value goods. All of these things come together and form what I call the social appraisement process. Without everyone being involved, without many different wills, remember Mises said there's only one will in the socialism, you cannot have a price system. You can't make up a price system without people interacting in markets and owning things and making their own decisions about how much they value those things and how much they will exchange them for. Okay. Okay, now let's just go on to how did the socialists react to all of this? Okay. How did they respond? Well, they took them seriously. Okay, for the first time, they took a critique of socialism seriously. They didn't just say, well, we'll have a new socialist man. Because he was saying, even if you did have a new socialist man that was working for the good of humankind, it wouldn't matter. Okay? Even if Mother Teresa was in charge, she couldn't calculate. Nobody can. It doesn't matter if you have goodwill or ill will. So what were some of the suggested solutions to the problem that Mises brought up? And the first responses were in German in the 1920s. Okay, because the German, which Mises obviously wrote his article in German. And some of them were truly hilarious. Otto Neurath, who was a socialist in Austria and knew Mises, but was a fanatical Marxist and not very smart, said, you know what? Why do we need money to calculate? We can calculate in terms of oranges and apples and steel and so on. Okay, labor hours, kilowatts of energy, we'll just calculate in natural terms, in natura, it was called, in kind, okay? What's wrong with that? Any grade school kid can tell you what's wrong with that. There's no common unit. How can you compare apples and oranges? Okay, so Mises easily dismissed that. The second came from reading Marx, because Marx claimed labor gave value, you know, labor was the sole source of value. So they said, look, labor hours our common unit, let's use labor hours to calculate. But think about it. Is the labor, an hour of labor, let's say, of a software engineer equal to the hour of labor of a McDonald's cashier? And are they equal to an hour of labor of, let's say, Kobe Bryant on the basketball court? Labor is heterogeneous, okay? In other words, we don't talk in abstract classes, labor, okay? It's the labor of a basketball player, the labor of a software engineer, the labor of a clothing designer, and so on. They can't be compared. It's just like comparing apples and oranges. Okay. Secondly, what about capital goods? Okay. How do you account for the fact that you use capital goods? If you use capital goods in a certain process, the difference between an American farmer today, the productivity of an American farmer today, and an American farmer 200 years ago, it's not that the American farmer today works harder in any sense. He may even work less hard. It's that the American farmer today is working with many more capital goods. So 2 hours of his labor is not comparable to 2 hours of a farmer 200 years ago. So depending on which industry you're in, you can't compare with different, or even in the same industry, if one laborer is using more capital than another laborer, he's going to be more productive. That the hour of his labor time is going to have a higher average productivity. And then what about land? How do you value land? Land isn't produced in any way. Okay? So you would leave out of account scarce capital goods and natural resources, even if there were, it was a common unit, which it's not. So Mises destroyed that response. We have a little bit more sophisticated response, which went as follows. What we'll do then, if capitalism ends, the day after capitalism ends, we'll keep all the managers on, we'll keep all the laborers working in those factories, and same technology, and we'll just tell the capitalists, do today what you did yesterday, and we'll pay you, your wages, and we'll pay the laborers their wages. And we'll be just as productive as a capitalist economy, and maybe even more productive. Well, what's wrong with that? That assumes that the economy is stationary. Consumer wants and tastes are continuously changing. New technologies are being discovered. Natural resources, some are being depleted. New sources are being found elsewhere. People are moving their locations if people are free to move. So labor is changing and is just being distributed differently, and so on and so forth. Okay, so it might work for the first week or two, but year after year, the economy is going to become more and more inefficient, because the whole purpose of an economy is to continually adjust the use of scarce resources to the most urgent human wants. Okay, not wants that somebody had 5 years ago. They're irrelevant. So this would only work if nothing ever changed again. So it's no solution whatsoever. And finally, calculating using utility, that assumes that there's a unit of measure of utility. Well, utility is like love. You can rank, if someone has three girlfriends, they can say, I like her more than her, and I like her B more than C, okay? And on that basis, you can choose to marry the one that you like the most, okay? You can't say, I love her twice as much as I love her. It doesn't make any sense. Utility is the same thing, okay? I prefer to go to a Rod Stewart concert three times as much as I prefer to go to a Paul McCartney concert. Actually, that's probably reversed. I did go to both, but years ago. But in any case, it doesn't make any sense. It's just that I prefer one. Well, I think I paid $125 to see Paul McCartney. This was years ago, and $85 to see Rod Stewart. I wouldn't pay a penny more than $85 to see Rod Stewart. So basically, I was revealing my preferences there. But I can't say I liked him 50% more or something like that. It doesn't make any sense. Okay. Now, much more sophisticated responses to Mises were made by British economists who discovered this literature in the 1930s and who were trained neoclassical economists but were socialists. So they were trained economists. So they took it very seriously. And they first said in general that, capitalism is a trial and error method, okay? You try to produce things at certain prices, you find that you can't produce them or they're not profitable at those prices, or that you can't sell them at those prices, you have to lower your price, or that you've produced a good that maybe has too high a quality, and therefore you have to reduce the quality of the good because the higher quality doesn't justify a higher price on the part of consumers, so on and so forth. That's trial and error. So they said, we can just apply a trial and error method to producing in a socialist economy. But as Mises pointed out, when you talk about trial and error, you have to know what you're looking for. What are you trying to find? So Mises says, a man loses his wallet. He uses this example. And he looks in various places. He retraces his steps and he looks in various places. But that's not a fruitless search because there's a distinguishing feature of the wallet. It's his wallet. He knows what it looks like. He knows what he's looking to find, okay? And when he finds it, he identifies it. Socialists don't know what the correct allocation of resources are. You can't know that outside the price system. So it's ridiculous to talk about trial and error. The entrepreneur under capitalism knows what he or she is looking for. Tomima Edmark knew she was looking for profits when she made that topsy curl device, okay? So she may have made mistakes in the beginning. She didn't have enough marketing. So she expanded her marketing and found that the profits went up. So she kept doing what she was doing because she was earning profits. Now, let's make that a little bit more concrete. Okay, so they wanted to use this trial and error method. One response was Well, we don't have to use trial and error. We can just use math. Let me talk about the mathematical solution. We can use the mathematical solution. Okay, all the supplies and demands, all the value scales, the supplies of resources, the technical production functions, all of those things can be put into equations. We can have a system of equations which would spit out, when they're solved, simultaneous equations, would spit out the correct prices for all the goods and the correct quantities. Okay, there wouldn't be real prices. There'd be shadow prices, but the correct quantities of all the goods, and so we'd have a correct allocation of resources. In fact, two non-socialists had pointed out this solution. Both of them were mathematical economists, Vilfredo Pareto, the Italian economist, and then his follower, Enrico Baroni. But neither of them believe that the solution, they've been playing with it like a math problem, but neither of them believe that the solution would exist in the real world because of the sheer number of equations that would be required, if nothing else. They didn't have computers, but this is in 1910 or so, they were playing around with this. So that was one solution. And another solution was what Mises calls the quasi-market, but which usually is called market socialism, okay? But notice something. The market socialist solution already gives the case to Mises. Mises already wins because they're admitting that you need prices, that you need markets. Okay. So I'll just briefly describe it. Each manager of a firm would make input and output decisions based on the prices that were set by the central planning board. So they would set prices, even arbitrary prices, for consumer goods and for the capital goods and natural resources. Okay. And they would tell the manager, you have to calculate using these prices. Don't try to look beyond these prices. Just calculate using these prices. And then you would minimize, and always make sure that you minimize your average cost, the cost per unit. And then they had another rule. You set it marginal cost equal to the price. But I want to get beyond that. Now, what would happen, though, if at the prices they set, there was an excess demand? Let's say they set a certain price for steel. Say, $100. But people wanted much more steel at $100. Entrepreneurs or managers wanted much more steel. Well, then they would raise the price. And if they raise it too much, then there would be a surplus of steel. So they'd lower the price. So they're bringing back the trial and error method. And eventually, these prices would converge on the equilibrium price. Okay. Well, the problem with this, first of all, Hayek and Lionel Robbins pointed out some problems with this, impracticality problem. They said all the economic data that is needed to sort of set these prices are scattered throughout the economy. And much of it is very subjective in nature. It's very hard to communicate between people in the form of statistics. And secondly, that the system of you have to change the prices so frequently. How frequently were you going to change the prices? Every week, every month? On a market, they change sometimes on a daily basis or hourly basis. Okay. So for Robbins and for Hayek, okay, two Austrian economists, it was very, very impractical. And they said, even if you get all the knowledge and you could solve, the problem. I'm actually talking about the mathematical solution here first, okay, the response to mathematical solution. So even if you could get all the data, solve the equations, by the time you collected all the data, solve the equations, it would be 6 months or a year, and it would already be irrelevant prices and quantities, okay? And then when they criticized the market socialism, they said, first of all, Hayek pointed out the Central Planning Board could not change prices as rapidly as the market. And secondly, price changes would not embody all of the relevant knowledge. So what Hayek said is that it would be extremely impractical. But neither of them really supported Mises in saying that would be impossible. So Mises had his own critique. And basically what Mises said was, let's take the mathematical solution. He said, let's say the central planner, he says, let's say he knows everything. He has all the scientists, engineers, technicians that he needs at his disposal, at his beck and call. He knows all of the technical information that he needs. He knows how to produce any good. He knows all the different ways of producing that good. He has an idea. Let's assume that he even knows what consumers would want in the future, okay, in some sense. So he points out that even if he knows what goods will be wanted in the future. Right now, in today's world, if you look around the United States, in our economy, what do we have? We have a huge capital stock. Most of our wealth is tied up in capital, okay? All the factories, the software, and so on, the commercial buildings. But many of those things were produced in the past, or the decision to produce them was in the past. And many of them embody mistakes, entrepreneurial mistakes. So the point is, they could not produce today what's going to be needed in terms of the equilibrium outputs, okay? Once everything is transformed so that you serve consumer wants perfectly. Okay, you can't just transform them today. So it takes time. Remember, it takes a long time for buildings to wear out. Or, for example, if you built a railroad and use all these resources in building a railroad, and you want to have more airplanes instead, the point is, the railroad is still valuable. It's not as valuable as you thought it would be, but you have to use it until it wears out. And as it's wearing out, you have to replace it with other capital goods. So what Mises pointed out is that you need prices and profits to tell you how to use these resources, which may have been produced in error, today, okay, and step by step, as they wear out, transform them into goods that are going to produce just those goods that give consumers serve consumers' highest value wants. But at every step, you need profits to do that and losses, okay? Unless you're willing to throw away all the capital goods and just take labor and land and then have them produce according to that set of equations. So Mises said you would then be thrown back into poverty. So for Mises, the point was, look, this world is continually changing. First of all, you're only talking about producing for given wants, okay, that consumers might have at some point in the future. But you can't even do that because you wouldn't know how to transform all the things you have, all the productive capacity you have, into that capacity that produces just what you want. Okay, but beyond that, of course, everything is changing. So as you started doing that, things would change again. In the capitalist economy, the entrepreneurs don't look at what equilibrium is, in some sense. What's the perfect adjustment of resources if everything stopped right now? What they do is they look at how people are changing their tastes, how resources are changing. Some are being depleted, some are being added to, developed, found. And that's what the market economy does. So it adjusts at every moment. It has to adjust to a new tendency. Okay. And then Mises also pointed out, in relation to market socialism, he said that look, who's setting these prices? The prices are being set by one will. So he called this is play market. This is like children setting up prices and playing like they're entrepreneurs. It's like playing Monopoly with fake money. That isn't a real economy. Okay. So his point with market socialism was that, look, as long as you have one person who owns everything, then that person can't find the right prices. Okay, he can only play. He can only tell. I can tell half the room, well, you guys buy from these guys. I'll set the prices, and then there'll be some sort of adjustment. I'll adjust the prices. But that, and this is the last point, mistakes capitalism. Capitalism is not a managerial economy where managers just blindly follow prices. Capitalism is an entrepreneurial economy where people own things. If you don't own things, if you can't trade things, if you don't have a stock market, Mises says, a bond market, if you don't have banks that can loan independently of the government, then you don't have a real economy. So what they would say was, they would come back and say, well, you know, we could have a government bank and people could bid for the loans, and then people who bid the highest interest rates, that would be the best use of the resources. But these people don't own anything. The managers don't own anything, so they have nothing to lose by bidding high interest rates. So, in other words, you cannot reproduce a market economy and its rational allocation of resources by simply playing a child's game. I'll stop there. Thank you.